Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Lane Davis, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Amy Voorhees. Dr. Voorhees is an independent scholar and the author of the new book, A New Christian Identity, Christian Science Origins and Experience in American Culture, published in 2021 by the University of North Carolina Press. In the review of the book, Publishers Weekly says that this book is a definitive look at Christian Science and establishes its founder, Mary Baker Eddy, as a major figure in America's faith history. And after reading the book myself, I wholeheartedly agree with that endorsement. So with that, Dr. Voorhees, welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you so much, Lane.
So we'll start with this. Your book is really this sweeping look at the origins of Christian Science and its founding in the 19th century. But for listeners that may not be as familiar with Christian Science as a religious movement, how would you describe the movement to someone who is maybe just picking up your book and reading about it for the first time?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that it's not Scientology. That might be like totally obvious to you and me as scholars of religion, but that is probably the biggest kind of misperception about Christian Science today. They're totally, completely unrelated. It is an expression of Christianity that was founded in the 19th century by Mary Baker Eddy. And she described or defined Christian Science as the law of God, the law of good. And she founded the Christian Science Church, and I'll just quote here, to commemorate the word and works of our master, by whom she meant Christ Jesus, which should reinstate primitive Christianity and its lost element of healing, unquote. So the challenge for scholars has been to arrive at a way of describing Christian Science in a historical sense that responds to Mary Baker Eddy's definition of it, that responds to what William James identifies as both subjective and objective data points, information points about the religion from both within and without. And so there have been a lot of ways that scholars have described Christian Science over the years. But I found that, I just finished writing a blog post called Why I Wrote This Book. So maybe I'll just pull on that, because excellent. What I found is that scholars consistently use three words to describe Christian Science. They use the word Christian, metaphysical, and healing. But, you know, if you just pause, I mean, as somebody who you're getting your PhD in religious studies right now.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's right.
You know, as I say those words, I'm sure you know right away, what do we mean by Christian? What do we mean by metaphysical? What do we mean by healing? Mm. The variety of definitions that scholars apply to those terms is truly broad.
Right.
So what I found is that there was kind of a challenge there. I really wrote this book to come up with an accurate way of describing Christian Science in a historical and scholarly sense, and to satisfy all of those data points, of input about what Christian Science is. And the definition that I arrive at draws on many of the definitions that scholars have used before, but hopefully takes a step forward in clarifying the meaning, kind of the terms within the terms. I call Christian Science a singular expression of Christianity with a restorationist revelatory healing rationale. And really, its central claim is to explain the divine law or Christian science that animated the healings of Jesus and that can be validated and proved in the modern era through a new system of applied Christian metaphysics, which is unlike the systems of metaphysics, of Christian metaphysics that have revolve around philosophical discussions, and wholly unlike other types of metaphysics that are involved in, well, we can talk about that later, but are involved in, you know, more, you know, occult sort of types of things, wholly apart from that, and a new type of Christian metaphysics that is applied primarily. So I really pulled apart what all these terms mean in detail and looked at a bunch of primary sources from all over the board. And does that answer your question, Lynn?
Yeah. Thank you. Right. That's so helpful. Okay. So I think the best place that maybe to kind of dive into the book then is to talk about the founder of Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy. Maybe just give us a general sense of who she was, and especially how she was formed by her childhood in 19th century New England. And there were a few sort of particular circumstances we can talk about, but maybe just a general sense of who she was first.
Yeah. And do feel free to raise any circumstances that you know, feel sure. would be interesting for listeners, but we do have documents from that time period that tell us some basics. We know that she lived in a New England farming community. She had two sisters and three brothers. So there was three girls and three boys in her family. She was the youngest. We have records of her family's reading material, their church attendance, the artifacts in their home. So we know that her family was pretty typical of their community. In my book, I call her family, quote, intellectual but not erudite, comfortable but not wealthy, civically engaged as a matter of course. Her father, Mark Baker, held like dozens of civic positions. I couldn't even fit them all in my book, but which was typical, very typical of agrarian, New England life at the time. We have a church record showing that she joined a Trinitarian congregational church in the 1830s. Her parents were members, but not her siblings, which was not, again, not uncommon. It was a big, big deal, as you certainly know, to profess religion back then. You had to get grilled. You know, you had to be examined on the state of your soul. You had to be certain about it. So for her to take that step was a big deal. And for her siblings to not take that step was not uncommon. We have records of New Hampshire state historians who talk about the value of education. There's one of my favorites is, I think it was Nathaniel Boughton, who is this ubiquitous New Hampshire state historian. There are a couple others, but who said education is the handmaid of religion. So, you know, these were descendants of the dissenting Protestants that left England mostly and Scotland and so forth. They left there because they were being, you know, marginalized and persecuted. And they're, for the most part, those are the folks who made up this farming community that Mary Baker already lived in. And so they were really specific about, you know, these, our children need to be educated and we are here so that we have the freedom to educate our children. Girls as well as boys were expected to be able to read the Bible directly, to contemplate the state of their souls, to write lengthy journal entries about you know, all this. So we have her school books too. We know that she took notes on Byron, Wordsworth, and Shakespeare, and she had like basic Latin from a really good Latin teacher who there's lots of records about people saying what a great Latin teacher he was. She had a smattering of Latin. She was tutored by her pastors and by her brother who went to Dartmouth. She had a fairly typical learning profile for a New England girl of her time, interrupted quite a bit by ill health.
Right. I think the health is an interesting kind of point to focus in here, because illness and health were particularly formative, you note. And she developed a relationship with a curious named Phineas Quimby. I was vaguely familiar with Quimby before reading your book, but the interaction that you talk about between her and Quimby was really influential for her life and for how her work developed. Could you maybe talk about who Phineas Quimby is and just the importance of his relationship with Mary Baker Eddy?
He was the last of kind of a series of what at the time they would have called irregular curists. which they're irregular in the sense of a lot of people were exploring different types of, I have to be careful with my words here, because we tend to overlay kind of a 20th century understanding of these things and say, oh, they're like alternative, you know, therapies or whatever. They really were not conceptualized that way. In fact, what I found really unexpectedly, this was when I was at the New Hampshire Historical Society and the Maine Historical Society, and I was reading through a lot of the periodicals from that time. And what I found was that a lot of these cures were conceptualized as possibly a new iteration of gospel healing. Huh. You know, is God acting through the water cure? Is God acting in some way through homeopathy? There's this really interesting sermon that I found, which is quoted in my book. You can find it there, but he talks about disease as a stubborn conviction, sort of a stubborn mood that affects the internal organs. Mm. And the only thing that can save us from that is Christian salvation, basically, you know. Mm. There's a lot of stuff about this, but there are a lot of theories about how this gospel healing might be operating through these curative systems, but there was no distinctive consensus by any means about really what the mechanism was or what it meant or if it actually was happening, you know? Right. So she was involved in exploring all of this, and she was, you know, a Congregationalist. She became more and more of a radical Congregationalist as the years went on. She spent about 20 years exploring different types of cures. And to answer your question, to get to the part about Quimby. So he was the last in this kind of 20-year period, the last guy that she went to as a curist. Mm-hmm. She really was, I think today we would describe him as, oh gosh, I mean, again, it's so hard not to overlay today's terms and kind of look backwards and kind of plop them onto 19th century experiences. So I guess I really sought to do this in the book, to look at how people described these things then, not to make judgments about how I might describe them now. Nobody knew what he was doing, really. He was, you know, there's a big question mark in the 1840s, 1850s about the role of electricity in healing, because electricity was just this like this new thing. Was it a new element? Was it a new, mm-hmm. you know, phenomena of some kind? And did God act through electricity? You know, in fact, I just picked up a copy of Brett Granger's book. I don't know if you've read it, The Church in the Wild.
I have not. I've seen it, but yes, go ahead.
Yeah. He talks about in that, it's a really interesting book. And he talks about this theology of electricity that evangelical Protestants had, where they were theorizing and questioning, does God act through this new element, this new thing, this new phenomena in some way to cure, to heal?
Right.
And of course, then there's the whole spiritualism thing that came in and squashed that conversation by the 1860s. It was moving in a different direction. But when Mary Baker Eddy was exploring these different curative systems and looking for what's the gospel element in these cures, that was how she certainly would have been culturally predisposed to see Quimby as somebody who was leveraging some kind of divine something or other, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's super helpful. So one of the experiences that I know is really important for her, it happens in 1866. She falls on the ice. Interestingly, there's not just a ton of documentation, it seems, around that experience, but the experience and then the effects of it seem incredibly profound for her life. Can you tell us what you found about that particular event and sort of what it means for the beginnings of Christian Science?
Yeah, well, I will say that there's just not a lot of primary source documentation.
Right.
So I was really cautious in how I described that because I wanted to stick to the documents that we have from that time period. There's one that I'll read. This is the Weekly Reporter from Lynn, Massachusetts, that in 1866 announced that, quote, she had, quote, fell upon the ice near the corner of Market and Oxford Streets on Thursday evening and was severely injured. She was taken up in an insensible condition and carried into the residence of S.M. Bouvier Esquire nearby, where she was kindly cared for during the night. Dr. Cushing, who was called for, found her injuries to be internal and of a severe nature, inducing spasms and internal suffering. She was removed to her home in Swampscott yesterday, which is a nearby town, though in very critical condition, unquote. So aside from that, we know that her minister was called for, which means that people expected her to die. And we know that she was really out of commission for a couple of days. And then 3 days later, she recalled later asking for her Bible and came out of her room and was walking, and that everyone there considered it miraculous and couldn't explain it. Importantly, she couldn't really explain it either at the time. And, you know, for most of 1866, she was really kind of going back and forth about what just happened. Like, it was obvious that there was some kind of new something or other going on in her life. But by the end of 1866, she seems to have settled on an understanding of this experience that was, she was able to parlay into a new religious expression.
So your book is not just a biography of Mary Baker Eddy. You've also done a lot of deep textual work on her writings. And it includes some of her early work, like the Genesis manuscript. Can you talk about that early writing and what were some of the ideological and intellectual problems that she was trying to work through as she'd had this experience in 1866 and now she was beginning this new movement and it was beginning to develop. How are the ideas developing along with that?
Yeah, well, I would say, that it was not particularly known as a new movement at that time. It was very, very small. But she was writing this manuscript. That was a primary thing that she was doing. And she titled it The Bible and Its Spiritual Meaning. Hmm. So she was setting out to explain the Bible in light of this new experience that she had had. And I think of that manuscript, I think of that document as an embodiment of this curative, this healing experience that she had had in 1866. She doesn't talk about that experience a lot, but she embodied it in this manuscript. For one thing, she wouldn't have been able to write the manuscript without having had that experience, because in late 1865, she was not able to work. She had written that, you know, she was ill again. Her health had been fluctuating quite a bit over the past couple of years. In the early 1860s, she was sometimes a lot better. Sometimes she was really way worse. And she kind of goes into her symptoms a lot. And she says at one point, I'm just not able to work. You know, she wrote to her brother-in-law, I'm sorry to afflict you with the afflicted, you know, but I need a fire. I need a room with a fire because I can't, you know, get fully dressed every day. And my side is so bad, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So she's unable to go through the laborious process of 19th century dressing, you know, in all these layers,
right?
You know, which is not inconsiderable, you know, and, you know, 50 billion buttons and, you know, 16 layers and so forth. And she couldn't go through that process and she couldn't sit at a writing desk all day and work. She also had a problem with poverty. You know, her husband was having issues and so forth. And so anyway, the fact that she was just able to sit and write was a major new development in the late 1860s. Hmm. I see this Genesis manuscript that she started to produce then and spent a couple of years writing in the late 1860s as an embodiment of her experience in 1866. And she's working through questions of how did that experience of that I'm identifying as a healing experience, how did that relate to earlier explorations of cure that I had looked into that didn't pan out for me? Mm-hmm. How does that experience relate to Quimby? She still had major questions, you know, is this kind of the same thing? But it was, you know, like he's not around anymore. He had passed on before she had that experience, that healing experience. But, you know, how does it relate? So she's working through and kind of grappling with those questions. She's asking questions about the nature of the biblical record about inspiration, revelation, explanation. How do I explain the Bible? What does revelation mean to have God disclose himself to you in an experience, to disclose the nature of creation and creation's relationship with a loving God? How do I explain that? I see all her grappling with all those things in that manuscript.
Huh, that's really interesting.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So the most famous text in Christian Science, of course, is Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. And here's how you describe it, and I'm quoting, then there was the core radicalism in Eddie's book, the claim that she and others had proved her Christian metaphysics by healing not only sin, but disease, and her readers could too, end quote. Talk about this text a bit and that core radicalism, as you call it. And I guess it would be also interesting just to kind of start maybe by talking about what kind of text it is, because you note there's been some misunderstanding about that from historians and from adherents equally. So, yeah, just talk a bit about that text if you can.
Okay, well, and redirect me as I talk if you want to kind of jump
in.
But
no problem.
Before I answer that, I'll just go to 1872, which is before she published her book in 1875. Mm-hmm. And it really is the outcome of an experiences that she had in 1872 that if the Genesis manuscript that she wrote in the late 1860s was the outcome of her 1866 healing experience, if it was the embodiment of that, which is kind of how I see it, then Science and Health really was the outcome of experiences that she had since 1866 and was enabled primarily by experiences she had in 1872 that finally caused her to answer all of those questions she had about how does this new thing, whatever it is, however I might describe it, how does this new thing relate to my previous experiences? Mm-hmm. And she, in that year, decided that her experiences with Quimby had been based on mesmerism. They weren't Christian healing. She thought that they were. She was hoping that they were. But it really explained to her why, under his care, her health had fluctuated so much and why there was never like a end point and a lot of questions, which I go into in detail in my book. Mm-hmm. But I should say, too, that I really work in my book to be really generous and respectful of both Quimby and Eddie, because the historiography is just so kind of all over the board with that. And I just didn't want to have a part of that.
Sure.
You know, but having made that decision really clearly that Christian Science is totally unrelated to the mesmeric tradition, which she had assumed all the time, but every new tradition, every new religion in this time period was accused of being mesmerism by this point.
Right.
You find this in all these documents. Faith healers were called mesmerists. Mormons were called mesmerists. Protestants called Roman Catholics mesmerists. You know, it's like all over the place. So it's not unusual that she would be called that. And everyone had to sort through, all these different traditions had to sort through what that meant for them. She did sort through that and really established her teachings very self-consciously against the mesmeric tradition, which is important. And so when you talk about what is science and health, well, it's a description of biblical interpretation, how she came to understand the Bible in light of this revelatory discovery, you know, that she had had. And
well, so I guess it's not scripture, though, because that's a misinterpretation right. that I still run into quite a bit with people who don't understand anything about Christian Science. And
right.
That's a key point of contention, right?
That's a really good point. Yes. And I do talk about that. Yeah. There's actually a pretty good scholarly record. I know I quote some scholars who say very clearly Science and Health is not a scripture, because it really isn't. You're right. It's a sacred text. We could call it that. But mm-hmm. to Christian Scientists and to Mary Baker Eddy, the Bible is the only scripture. And this Science and Health is a key to the scriptures. That's a subtitle. Science and Health is a key to the scriptures.
So Christian Science adherents, they eventually feel that they have to start their own church. What led to this?
Well, Mary Baker Eddy was not like a come outer, sort of like Joseph Smith or like Ellen Harmon White, who really felt called to leave the established church, sometimes with kind of spicy words about it, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had a vision for something totally different that they felt was more sacred. She was not like that. She remained a congregational church member very happily through the 1870s, through the middle 1870s, even while she was writing her book. And she expected her church to accept her book. Mm-hmm. She really engaged in her book a lot of key questions that Congregationalists were asking then. And I cite a lot of this source material, but you know, there's like, does matter exist? I mean, that, you know, like what do we think of Darwinism? Is that, does that mean that God is, you know, under material laws and not vice versa? You know, metaphysical questions,
right?
What is reality? What is the reality of the universe and how do I describe it? The key question of how did Jesus heal? And can I heal in the same way? What is the atonement? You know, what is prayer? How do I think about prayer? How do I practice prayer in an effective way in this time period when religion is being turned on its head and is no longer has the authority that it used to have in cultural terms? So she's really engaging all of those questions and answering them in Science and Health.
And these questions weren't sort of accepted by the Congregationalists of the day. they were very much sort of pushed outside, I'm guessing, because of these questions.
Yeah. I mean, the Congregational Church did not accept them and say, oh, this is now the new direction that we're going in, mm-hmm. you know, but her parting with the Congregational Church was mutually warm. There was never like a big rift or anything. They recommended her to, I think, quote, any evangelical church. You know, that's what her mm-hmm. letter says. You know, she's right. a member in good standing. And she very self-consciously, you know, she called her church the most evangelical church. You know, she identified it that way.
Right. I was especially interested in how you talked about some of the interactions of the Christian Science church to many of the people who are outside of the movement, both mm-hmm. both in the Christian church, but also in other religious movements of the time. And you talk about some of the interactions that Christian Science had with the Theosophy movement. That was especially interesting. Can you talk some about that?
Yeah, that was very interesting to me to dive into. During the 1880s, Christian Science was growing quite a bit, and there were a lot of Christians who were attracted to the innovative. I always try and use kind of positive words to describe rather than like, if you say unorthodox, let's kind of saying what it is.
Right.
You know, so I try and say singular, not that it's okay, you know, maybe, you know, so anyway.
Very contested terms. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I try and do that with all new religious expressions of new types of Christianity. You know, I try and apply those to everybody. So many Christians were attracted to the unorthodox or innovative theological statements and mm-hmm. the healing experiences primarily that they saw in Christian Science. And I talk about this guy, O.P. Gifford. He was a Baptist minister, really like super well-known Baptist minister who really championed Christian Science throughout his entire career. He was not like super uncommon, you know, to have that type of response from within the established Christian church. There were also folks who really objected to it and said, oh, this is the worst thing that has ever happened, and it's leading the faithful astray. And I include lots of examples of those types of folks. Then you have the theosophical movement, which started to burgeon also in the 1880s. And so folks who were theosophical or theosophically adjacent, sort of interested in it, they became attracted to Christian Science because of these unorthodox statements. For example, Mary Baker Eddy totally reconsiders the fall of you know, Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. She calls, which a lot of people were doing then. She wasn't the only one, but she did it in a unique way. She calls Eve not innocent, but first to confess her fault. So mm-hmm. she said Eve was morally strong and she did the wrong thing. And she said so immediately. And that made her more spiritually minded. And, mm-hmm. you know, so she called God, Mary Baker Eddy called God Father Mother, which of course, if we look into the, you know, the sources, we find a lot of people doing that, but nobody did it to the degree that she did. And it became such an established kind of Christian Science term that it became associated with her movement primarily. Mm-hmm. And so the theosophically minded folks became interested in these aspects, these unorthodox or innovative aspects of Christian Science theology, and really dove into it, but they didn't want to leave behind their theosophical commitments. And this became a major, major conflict where they would intensely affiliate with Christian Science for a time. I found one letter in which a woman called herself an inquirer into Christian Science. She read Science and Health. She was eclectic. She liked all the scriptures, all the world scriptures, you know. Mm-hmm. And she wrote to Mary Baker Eddy saying, her name was Diaz, Abby Morton Diaz. And she wrote to Mary Baker Eddy saying, you know, you might disagree with how I see your religion, but I think that it's unfairly persecuted. People aren't saying the right things about it. And Mrs. Eddy, as she was called, wrote back to Mrs. Diaz and said, you know, I don't entirely, she didn't entirely agree, you know, you're right, but she was very respectful and said, you know, if you'd like to come study with me and so forth, you can. And Abby Diaz declined and she went her own way. And, but there were a lot of kind of interactions like this in the 1880s. Where theosophists and those who had like an interest in eclectic literature and eclectic religious viewpoints, they got into Christian Science and they found that they couldn't accept the exclusive Christian aspects of it, the basic Christianity of it. They really disagreed that Mary Baker Eddy should be considered the founder of Christian Science. You know, she just kind of happened to be there. Huh. Right.
Yeah. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was also interested in some of the legal issues that the church faced early in its origins. And that's just something I'm kind of always interested in, is just how churches and religious movements define themselves over and against so the way that societies and try to do so through laws. So just for legal purposes, you know, what were some of the struggles that the church was going through during this early period of its growth?
Well, I know there's a really interesting article that David Holland wrote. It's in an anthology put out by David Hempton, was one of the editors, mm-hmm. about how some of the court cases levied against Mary Baker Eddy. There were two major court cases against her as an individual, really for very interesting reasons that I get into in the book. And then a lot of biographers and other scholars have already covered quite a bit. One was called the Next Friend Suit. And that's the one that David Holland talks about in terms of how definitions of religion were impacted by the findings in that suit. But probably what you might be talking about a little bit more is that I spend a little bit of time in my book talking about a handful of court cases that popped up around 1900 that where legislatures around the country, state legislatures, sought to limit Christian Science practice on the basis of licensing. Mm. So scholars have established that these cases did revolve mostly around licensing, meaning whether or not the practitioner held a mainstream or standardized medical license, which of course most didn't. And there's also a fair amount of scholarship that explores the larger cultural push at this time toward establishing mainstream medical options for treatment as primary. And so you find these well-established systems like homeopathy and so forth increasingly and systematically marginalized by that push. But in the case of Christian Science, the conversation was rather different because of the entirely religious nature and identity of the practice. There's no physical accompaniment to prayer that can be licensed in a traditional sense.
All right.
So the conversation often became explicitly religious. And I found that there was kind of these people don't have a right to practice the system of healing. Their theology is not my theology. I don't get it. Religious healing is outright impossible. So it cannot exist, even though it might appear to, it cannot. Mm. And then you have the recorded court testimony of Christian Scientists in response, some of which was kind of immature and sort of self-righteous, some of which was very even-toned, very mature, and laid out thoughtful reasons that religious healing can and does exist. And I found that the question of efficacy, this was a big surprise to me. I thought that these cases would revolve around efficacy. And even though scholars tend not to engage in that question, because it's not really a historical question, in some basic ways. This mm-hmm. I lay out in my book why that is and cite all the literature and so forth. But I did observe the conversation and I found three types of discussions around efficacy that often aren't accounted for in the admittedly small grouping of academic literature on this topic. One is that sometimes the patient was happy with their treatment mm-hmm. and efficacy was presumed. So the patient was fine. They were happy with everything. And the case literally and entirely rested on medical licensing without any discussion of efficacy at all. Hmm. Sometimes courts ruled that efficacy wasn't theirs to decide. In one 1889 Ohio case, the appeals court ruled that, quote, what efficacy there may be in treating bodily ills through means, such as prayer, the court is not called upon to decide, unquote. And the judgment granted, quote, perfect sincerity to a now considerable number of highly respectable persons, unquote, employing Christian Science, et cetera. And they found it impossible to rule that this healing practice was medical in nature, as it didn't involve medicines, medical training, or medical or physical diagnoses. And their decision was therefore that it's clearly a religious belief, they called it, quote, unquote. This is a type of religious belief. And the court further commented that it does not punish those of other sects who sought healing and seek healing through contact with, for example, holy relics and, you know, other types of religious healing, so that, quote, if it applies to one class, it must also apply to the other. I didn't expect that kind of conversation. I was like surprised by this. In that particular case, the Christian Scientist had accepted a modest donation to treat the patient. And most state licensing laws required a billing transaction to establish professional activity as opposed to a charity. So because in this case, it was a charity, it was a donation instead of a bill, the case was resolved on that basis and on these other factors that I quoted. Finally, I think in other cases, people struggle to say why Christian Scientists should be persecuted for their failures when medical doctors were not. And they struggled to find evidence that these failures were greater in number or in value than medical failures. I know I've mentioned this before, maybe it was in a conversation that's not in this recording, but one of my book's unexpected research findings is that even Mary Baker Eddy's severest critics from the 1870s onward routinely accepted evidence that her religion healed. They would say, yes, there are healings that go on here, but they proposed that this was because of religious, medical, or philosophically fraudulent reasons. It's not the right theology. It's not medically allowed. It's not philosophically rational. And then you have these voices like this guy I quote in the book, who you'll know about, William Lloyd Garrison III. He's mm-hmm. a grandson of the famous abolitionist. Mm-hmm. And he testified to a state legislature that he didn't understand Christian Science theology. He didn't agree with what he called its, quote, biblical dogmas. He was a medical man himself. But he also didn't agree that it should draw special scrutiny based on its unorthodox approach to healing. He said, that from his own enforced observation, is how he termed it, that he saw cases of physical and moral regeneration through its practice that led him to feel, quote, whatever the cause of this phenomenal and widespread change, it seems to me a blessing to the world, unquote. I really didn't expect to find voices of this stature like that in the historical record or this variety that I just cited.
Well, all of this has been really interesting, and I really appreciate your time today. But before we finish, I do want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the argument that frames your book, because it is a really nuanced thesis that I think deserves a lot of thoughtful attention. So in the beginning of the book, you argue, as early Christian Science adherents engage the Bible as interpreted by Mary Baker Eddy's Science and Health with the Key to the Scriptures, they forged a new Christian identity. And this religious identity mediated modernity in distinctive ways, not least through experiences deemed healing, understood not as ends in themselves, but as waymarks, pointing to something Christians by definition consider more important, salvation or the redemption of human life based on a new view of God and Jesus Christ. So with this argument, I guess the question is, what was this identity like? What would it have been like to have been a Christian Scientist in the 1890s?
Someone who is a Christian Scientist in the 1890s would have almost invariably come to it through a healing experience. They would have had an account of healing that was central to their religious experience that brought them into this church. It would have been a kind of a scrappy time. That's a word that comes to thought. It's a very young organization at that time. Mm-hmm. Kind of heady, you know, the organization was growing faster than any other church or religion in America then. Mm. Based on cultural conversations around Christian Science, it would be a time where you're sifting through and establishing outside perceptions of what your religion is and establishing what Christian Science identity is to you. It would be a time of really working to understand Mary Baker Eddy as a religious founder. In my book, there are a lot of private artifacts and portraits that I reprint and talk about that give us glimpses into adherent spirituality, where Christian scientists are handling their religious books and filling them with marginal notations. And several of them went through Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures and notated Bible passages on like every page. Of course, it includes over 700 Bible, you know, it's a Bible based text, right? So they went through and they compared it with their Bibles and studied the two together. We have these portraits of people holding their religious texts, their scriptures, and their Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, holding them together with affection. It was just a time of phenomenal growth. And you could have come from any religious, racial, ethnic, or economic background. There was a lot more diversity in the membership than is often presupposed. Mm. And I do try and really sketch out some of that and bring a voice to some of that diversity in my book as well.
Well, it is really interesting. Amy Voorhees is the author of A New Christian Identity, Christian Science Origins and Experience in American Culture, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2021. Dr. Voorhees, it has been a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for the time, and thank you for bearing with our technical difficulties that listeners hopefully will not know anything about. But congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you so much, Lane.
And thank you for listening to New Books in History. Make sure to check out the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com or anywhere that you can stream and download podcasts. And make sure to subscribe to our history channel so that you can keep up with all of the best in new scholarship and writing that is out there right now. Thanks so much and enjoy your reading.